Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Exposed Vet Radio Show. The Exposed Vet Radio Show, we discuss issues affecting today's veteran. Now, here's your host, John M. Ray.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Exposed Vet Radio Show on this beautiful Thursday, March the 7th, 2024. Don't forget this weekend to spring forward, set your clocks forward, unless you live in a state that doesn't do that. So if you live in a state that don't do that, you need to leave your clocks alone because you don't want to get to work too early. But anyhow, today is series two. We're working on DVQs. And there we got Mr. Ray Cobb, your co-host. How you doing, Ray?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day down here. And I was looking over here at the chart, and I see down here in my area that Bill and Paula's listening in tonight, so that's good. Glad to have them on board.
Good. Oh, that's good, huh? Yeah, we're getting quite a few folks in the queue. I've seen James yet. There he is. There's Mr. Cripps. Let me pop him in, too. And he's got his hand up, so I guess he wants to. But anyhow. Yeah, okay. Now, we've got one of our favorite people on tonight. She is a Valor Vet, and any way you want to look at it, when you look at Valor Vet, I think of Bethany. I don't think of Valor Vet, but she's been a friend for a couple of years now, and she's a physician assistant. She owns Valor Vet, and she's going to give us a rundown on another DBQ. I think we're going to discuss heart disease. Is that right, Bethany?
That is correct.
All right. So, well, then let's go ahead and get you started because this is a big topic because everybody on here tonight that I know is service-connected with heart disease.
Yeah.
It is a big one. It is a big one. Yeah. So I'm actually 10 pages. So what I wanted to do is talk predominantly about the ischemic heart disease and a little bit of heart failure. If you've got some extra time, I'll circle back to the arrhythmia, and then we can touch on a few other things. But I mean, the list is like 20-plus diagnoses, and there's multiple sections. So I really want to focus on, what the veterans should expect, what kind of questions they should expect, and, what evidence they need to bring to their exam for this disability. So,
okay.
All right, so I've got the DVQ in front of me. If you don't mind, I'll just jump in and get started.
You're right ahead. I've got it memorized.
Oh, goodness. All right, so starting with page one of the heart condition to include ischemia and non-ischemic heart disease, arrhythmias, valvular disease, and cardiac surgery. So this is the big DVQ. It was released in June of 2023. And our first page starts off, like all the other DBQs, asking questions about the individual filling out the form. Is the provider a VA provider? Is the veteran that they're filling the DBQ out for, are they regularly seen in that provider's clinic? And is the veteran being examined in person? Now, I will say, for heart conditions, most of them do not require a face-to-face visit. Some of them do. I prefer to do these in person because your cardiac history is typically a pretty long one. And I think that when you look at your patient, you can really see some of the secondary effects, whether it's, some oxygen deprivation or other components to their cardiac condition that you can appreciate in person. So for me, if I'm a provider, I want to do this DVQ in person. So that's the top section talking about, who's filling it out. The next section, just like the hypertension DBQ as well, is the evidence section. The veteran should always have their evidence in the file prior to their visit for their disability exam. And when we look at the cardiac conditions, the big records that have the most valuable information are any type of emergency room records that the veteran may have gone to the ER for chest pain. So if they're there for chest pain, they're going to get worked up with some cardiac enzymes, a chest X-ray, an ECG. That information is valuable. So you definitely want to make sure that emergency room visits are in there. especially if it's related to having chest pain and heart issues. The next thing that I recommend as far as evidence is any type of procedure, cardiac procedure, like cardiac cath, any type of stent placement procedure note. I've had a couple cases where the veteran didn't have a stent placed because they didn't meet the criteria to have the stent placed. But because of the report in the cardiac catheter report, I was able to confirm that they did in fact have ischemic heart disease and met the criteria for that service connection. So that can be valuable. And then also, if you have cardiac ultrasound, like an echo cardiogram, an echo ultrasound, that's going to show the vascular, not necessarily the vessels themselves, but how the muscles are functioning in the ejection fraction related to the heart. So if there's some type of vessel that's being blocked, it can affect a certain area of the heart muscle, and we can see that on the echo. So those are musts when it comes to the evidence. So lots of stuff there. Any questions about that? Any suggestions? As you say, all of you have it. So then,
one question. Now, was it 21? They changed the rating schedule. They changed the criteria for heart disease. It went from basically ejection fraction to MET admits. Is that what I'm understanding?
They did change it, and I'm glad they did. So, and we can talk about that towards the end, mainly because the current DBQ actually matches what's in the N21 now. As always, the 38 CFR never changed. So, any other things or suggestions for evidence questions?
One question, Bethany, there when you were talking a moment ago about when they did your workup and everything, if they went in and they found two blockages, I know where I go to at Alvin C. York, if you have two blockages and they send you for open heart surgery and do bypass, but if you only have one, then they try to stent. Is that the case all over the country? Is that a VA decision, or is that just a local decision made at our local VA?
That's going to be a decision at the local VA. And I think, the biggest thing that it's going to weigh on is that the comfort of the cardiologist, the experience, and what medical care is accessible to them. So if your VA has access to doing the more invasive procedures, and then if something would go wrong, they have a resource to get you help immediately, then that's something that they consider when they decide on whether or not they're going to do a procedure or a
It should also depend on where it's at in your heart, too, but sometimes they can't get to your heart with a cath like that.
Right.
So, well, yeah. So maybe behind the heart or the widowmaker, things like that's hard to get to.
Yeah, mine was behind the heart, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I will also say that there are standard agreements, or like, I forget what they call them, but like things that they will and they will not see at the VA. So care line agreements. So for that specialty for cardiology, if there's certain things that the provider, like let's say the primary care provider, wants this patient seen for X, Y, and Z, that VA may be like, no, we don't see those. We refer those to the outside. So it's just going to depend on each VA and what that cardiologist is comfortable with and what tools they have to treat the condition.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to transition to the long list of diagnosis section. Okay. Every DBQ has a diagnosis section, and I'm going to start the very first one, and I can't emphasize this enough. The very first box for the diagnosis section says, the veteran does not have a current diagnosis associated with any claim condition listed above. So the reason I bring that up is that if they look through your records and you have not provided adequate evidence to that provider's liking that you have a cardiac condition, they will mark that box and they will move on. what is absolutely necessary, meaning move on, meaning if they won't see you, they won't call you, they will mark that button that says no diagnosis, and they will push their claim, your claim back to the VA for that rater to make a decision on. So absolutely important that you get that evidence in front of the provider prior to your appointment. The next few boxes, you've got acute, which means something that's happened in a short time frame, subacute or old myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack. Then we have atherosclerotic, cardiovascular disease. Q down, we have arteriosclerotic. So there actually is a difference between atherosclerotic and arteriosclerotic. They're very minor. So sometimes they're used interchangeably, but they both qualify for coronary artery disease. One is where the vessel itself just gets really hard and stiff, and the other one is looking at the plaque buildup, so within the vessel. Then we have unstable and stable angina, which is chest pain. We have a coronary spasm. We have congestive heart failure. We have coronary artery bypass stuff. Those diagnoses would qualify for ischemic heart disease or the coronary artery disease benefit. All right. I'm going to turn to page 3 and just jumping into the medical history. If you look at the DBQ itself, there's not enough room to put the full history in that box. And this is something that frustrates me because I have to try to cram all of the history into that box. And a lot of times, those with coronary artery disease, ischemic heart disease, the history is not short. It's, you know, I started to develop chest pain, and then something led to a sudden need for a heart stent, maybe 3 events of having heart stents over the last 3 years, and they end up with a coronary artery bypass, and they have some type of arrhythmia and then congestive heart failure. So it's really messy sometimes, and they don't leave a lot of room for the provider to put that information in there. So going down further for the medical history, they front up ask, does the veteran have any condition that qualifies for ischemic heart disease? That's where they're trying to capture that presumptive condition, because that's predominantly where these claims are coming from. And again, I mentioned those conditions that I read off, those would qualify for ischemic heart disease. So, and then we jump down a little bit further. They want to know what other heart conditions that the veteran has and how it may be related. So for the heart condition, if the provider identifies that the veteran has congestive heart failure, then the provider would indicate the cause for that congestive heart failure. And there could be several causes for congestive heart failure. We do see it in ischemic heart disease. We see it a lot in valve disease. We can see it in those who have hypertension, where the heart muscle changes and it's not doing an adequate job. That can lead to congestive heart failure. It's not as common, but I have seen it. And then there is a section there for the provider to lay out all the other cardiac conditions and what may be related to the ischemic heart disease or to these other cardiac conditions. Because a lot of the cardiac conditions are interrelated, and they want that provider to lay the information out so that the rater can give the veteran the highest rating possible. All right, any questions about the history?
You know, the congestive heart failure, I've had a lot of heart trouble. I actually won my ischemic heart disease back before it was presumptive of Agent Orange. I had to go the secondary to diabetes route. I'm on my 5th defibrillator. Big problem now is congestive heart failure. I just got out of the hospital a couple of days ago. I had accumulated 24 pounds of water.
Wow.
It's tough. It is tough.
That's a lot. It's a lot of fluid.
It's a lot. you know, you
breathing,
get
walking, moving, that's all of that.
Yeah, you can't breathe, you can't talk, you just can't do anything. And I got to thinking about that the other day when I got out of the hospital. I thought, gosh, 3 gallons of water. So I went to the kitchen sink and I drew up 3 gallons of water. And let me tell you, I've got a bottle of water sitting here beside me now. I don't even want to take a drink of it. I'm full of water. But heart disease is, that's one that you're not going to get over.
Do you mind sharing kind of how your history progressed to develop congestive heart failure? I know that's a personal question, but kind of, you know, lay the story to what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I was actually exposed to Agent Orange at Fort Gordon, Georgia. And I got out of the service in 1970. Used to play music. And I was playing the harmonica one night in a band. And my tongue got sore, my jaws got sore, got sore down my throat. And I just kept playing, kept singing, and it went away. The next Saturday night, my harmonica started playing music, same thing happened. I looked at those harmonicas and I thought, gosh, I got a germ in these things. I'm about to boil them out. But that was turned out to be a full-blown heart attack. Two stents, bypass surgery. Went back later, had a defibrillator. Like I say, I'm on the fifth one now. But I'm still living. I'm still making plans. So, hoping to fly out to Biloxi, Mississippi Monday. Took a little vacation. You just got to have the right attitude to live with it and adjust.
In my experience from the clinical side, when you get to the point of congestive heart failure, the medications really do, they're important in lengthening your lifespan and really controlling some of those symptoms and conditions that develop from congestive heart failure.
My doctor tells me that my medications and my wife are the only thing keeping me alive. And he said, not necessarily in that order. But the side effects of the medication are not good. They're life-changing.
Yeah. Anytime you develop if you get a myocardial infarction, or even if your cardiac staff shows a certain percentage of blockage, normally the standard practice is they throw five standard medications at you. And to start with, that can be very difficult to start to tolerate. You kind of have to allow your body to adjust to some of those medications. So even if you have a little bit of heart disease or a lot of heart disease, there's always a lot of medication management that goes in.
You know, there is one thing that I would like to get out there. Should you ever find yourself in need of a pacemaker, advocate for yourself. Don't go with the pacemaker. Argue for the defibrillator. It's the exact same operation, just a little bit bigger unit, one more wire, and it's a lifesaver. It's actually saved my life twice now. So, you know, if you're going to have to carry around the weight of that defibrillator and deal with it, you know, go with the Cadillac.
All right. So I'm going to transition into the next section on the bottom of page 3. We've already touched base on this section. It's myocardial infarction. Normally, that's the first symptom or recognition of a veteran having some type of ischemic heart disease. I've had patients in their 30s have an MI in the emergency room. And it can happen. I'm not saying that to scare you. I'm just saying, scare anybody that's listening, just saying that normally that's the first onset. You don't always have symptoms of coronary artery disease prior to its onset. But healthy lifestyle, diet, not being exposed to Agent Orange or other toxins is helpful, but there's only so much you can control in that. And heart valve condition. Your ischemic heart disease is your predominant cardiac condition you see from the disability side. From there, it triggers, often ischemic heart disease can trigger an arrhythmia. It is very rare that a heart, ischemic heart condition starts to affect the heart valve. When you get in some of your more severe congestive heart failure, you can affect the heart valve. But on the order of occurrence, it's going to be predominantly your ischemic heart disease, then your arrhythmias, then your heart valve condition. If I switch over to page 5, we're looking at pericardial effusion. That is when you get scarring around the heart, and that is not a common association with ischemic heart disease itself. Normally secondary to an infection of the covering of the heart. You may see it with some of your open heart surgeries, with the CABG procedures, but it's typically not that common. And we really don't appreciate the presence of pericardial effusions until you go back into surgery for a second time, or if we're doing some type of imaging that would appreciate the effusion. So it's not something that we see often in the medical side of things. The next section jumps into procedures, and it's talking about your it's talking about PCIs or percutaneous coronary intervention. Those are your heart stents. That's when they go into your groin or into your wrist, and they put take a guide up to your heart, and they place heart stents or a cage basically to open that artery and to improve blood flow. Normally after that, you're on blood thinners for a little bit. Depending on the type of stent that's placed, you may not have to have it as long. The next procedure is your coronary artery bypass surgery. Normally we call this a CABG. It's when they open you all the way down the chest, from the top of your sternum typically to the bottom of your sternum. It's a pretty long scar. It's usually pretty deep and pretty thick. So if you've had a CABG, the compensation and pension examiner should also be doing a scars exam, measuring the scar, not only the length, but the width. They should be pushing on the scar to see if it's painful and looking to see if the skin is well healed or if you're having issues with irritation of the scar. The other procedures include any type of cardiac transplant, which we don't see a lot of with ischemic heart disease, the pacemakers and your defibrillators, which we do see in the severe ischemic heart disease or the arrhythmias. Again, that's targeting the heart valve itself. We don't see a whole lot of heart valve damage from ischemic heart disease. A lot of your heart valve damage comes from previous infection, some type of muscle, like heart muscle abnormality, because it's not allowing a good seal. There can get scarring on some of the I call them leaflets, the cusps that come down. That's typically what would indicate a heart valve replacement. Then we flip it over to page 6. We have a few other procedures, but they leave it open for other procedures that were not described above. It's about hospitalization. The next section, which is section 10, talks about the physical examination. For the provider, this is always interesting because there's nothing in the physical examination component that actually affects the rating schedule. So they ask for the heart rate, they ask for the blood pressure, they ask for the heart rhythm. They ask for what they call the point of maximal impact, which is when you feel, the provider will feel the chest and try to find where the heart the end of the heart is placed. None of that affects what the individual veteran is getting for their cardiac condition. So it's interesting that some of these components are on there. For me, I just do it because they ask. That's why I always want to do an in-person exam. But that's not, it's not always indicated for each veteran. But you don't know that until the veteran's in front of you. Is any other pertinent physical findings or complications associated with the cardiac condition? Page 7 is when we look at diagnostic testing, looking at EKGs, chest x-rays, echoes, all of that we've talked about. They're just documenting the finding related to that testing. The last section on page 8 is where we get into the meat of the rating schedule itself. So that is the metabolic equivalent for MET testing. And for this section, I'm going to read exactly what it says on page 2. For VA purposes, all heart exams require MET testing or interview based to determine the activity level at which symptoms such as breathlessness, fatigue, angina, dizziness, or syncope develop, except exams for supraventricular arrhythmia, which is moving arrhythmia suicide. If a laboratory determination for MET by exercise testing cannot be done for medical reasons, then perform an interview-based MET test based on the veteran's responses to a cardiac activity questionnaire and provide the results below. So I read that because 10 years ago, this was much different. And this is what, John, you were talking about earlier about them changing the rating schedule and how the MET testing and how they rate it. Test testing versus ejection fraction. So 10 years ago, the DBQ just outlined the MET. And they were instructing the examiners to invent the MET testing. And what they would do, instead of taking an interview-based MET, which is me asking questions of what the veteran is capable of, they would want me to reference the echo or the ultrasound and how well that heart is pumping. So if we look at ischemic heart disease, which is the blood vessels, that doesn't necessarily tell us how well the muscle is functioning. Yes, the vessels can affect the muscle, but you can have a severe ischemic heart disease and no abnormal muscle function. So they gave the veteran the benefit of the MET testing, which was subjective, interview-based, then the veteran would get a higher rating. But if they gave a rating based off the ejection fraction, then they would give the veteran a lower rating. So now they have changed it to where they can either do an interview-based or an exercise stress test. So when they put you on the treadmill, they can actually look and get a metabolic equivalent testing, MET, MET score from that exercise stress test. So now they've opened it up to say, okay, have they done an exercise stress test or are you doing an interview to capture the MET? So when we look at the metabolic equivalence testing, I'm going to read word for word some of the MET interview. So when I am conducting an exam and I'm trying to get a MET score, I ask the veteran, do you have any of the following? Breathlessness, fatigue, angina, dizziness, do you pass out? Do you have any other heart symptoms? Say yes, then that is a 1-3 MET. If they say no, then I move on to the next question. And I ask the veteran, do you develop any breathlessness, fatigue, chest pain, dizziness? Do you pass out or develop any other heart symptoms when you're mowing the lawn or when you're doing a brisk walk or even when you're doing weeding into the yard? And if they say yes, then that's a 3-5 MET score. Do they develop any breathlessness, fatigue, chest pain, dizziness, or do they pass out? or develop any heart symptoms when they're walking up one flight of stairs, if they go golfing without a cart, or if they're push mowing their lawn. And if they say yes, that's a 5 to 7 month. Excuse me, we're looking to see when the veteran develops symptoms. So if they didn't develop while they're using a power mower mowing their lawn, but they're developing it when they're push mowing, then they have a 5 to 7 month. Does that make sense? So when we look at the maximal MET score, which is a 7 to 10 MET, that means that the veteran, they're able to do moderate bicycling. They're able to jog 6 miles per hour specifically or climb stairs quickly. So that's a 7 to 10 MET. So normally that's an interview base. And so it's based off of what the veteran is telling you. If the veteran is telling you that they develop chest pain when they're power mowing their lawn, but they don't develop chest pain when they're taking a shower, then they would sit at a 3 to 5 MET. Lung disease, and they're developing that breathlessness when they're mowing their lawn, that's still an indication of cardiac involvement. So they would still qualify for that lower MET score. Now, those questions that I read are word for word in the DBQ. So they tried to take those numbers and throw it into the rating schedule in order to set out a disability rating percentage. John, you may be a little bit better at kind of explaining that.
As far as so repeat that real quick.
I'm sorry, I had trouble hearing you. I look at the MET scoring from a clinical side, and
yeah.
I think that you may have a better understanding of what I'm trying to say from the non-medical side. So I was just going to kind of have you step in and talk about.
What she's saying, though, I mean, you know, you can, if on an everyday basis, you know, if the vet, say, for example, you live on a little incline, maybe your mailbox is probably 150 feet from your house. And you walk to your mailbox and get your mail, walking down the hill, you know, you're pretty much okay. You know, you hobble a little bit, but you turn around and start walking back up the hill and you get 30 or 40 yards. Next thing you know, your legs start getting tired. You have to stop and things like that. That's part of it, you know. And because your heart, you know, it affects your vascular system too. And if your legs start to get tired, it's called coagulation. And basically, it's not strong enough to pump blood to the bottom of your body to return. And so your legs start getting really tired, or get really weak, and you have to stop, and it takes a few minutes to get it back. Another issue is you eat. Once you eat, and especially if you eat a good amount of food, you can be sitting there, and next thing you know, you'll get short of breath. And next thing you know, your pulse is going to take off flying really, really fast. And eventually it'll come back down and calm down, but that shortness of breath itself, you may not have chest pain because in our situation, guys, we're diabetics, and, you know, we probably won't feel chest pain. Because I know a lot of diabetics had heart attacks and died and didn't even feel it, or had heart attacks and didn't know it. So does that make sense?
Yeah, that's helpful.
You know, now that I've gotten old and got a few gray hairs, there's two ways to go about that. You know, I had plenty of warning. I had plenty of signs that I had heart failure, and I just kind of pushed it back and didn't pay any attention. So I had to do it the hard way. I had to go the heart attack and the bypass and the pacemaker. And, you know, I would strongly suggest just going ahead and asking your doctor to do a heart workup, and not have to deal with all of the damage to the heart after the infarction. Two ways to do it, guys. You know, just surrender and get the heart workup, or deal with what you're setting yourself up for.
Now, you know, there's two types of cardiologists, too, involved with this, right? We've got we call them plumbers for the regular for the regular heart doctors. Then we also, we got electricians, and they're called electrophysiologists. Fortunately, the VA's got both. And if you have, you know, if you have issues with arrhythmias and things like that, or pacemakers and stuff like that, that's the EP doctor to take care of that. The plumbers are just the guys that do the heart cast and the stress test. So it all depends on who you see at the VA or outside the VA.
Heck, they even got drain surgeons.
Drain surgeons? Yeah, they do. They're big great employees.
I have a question.
Deal with all of them, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, when we were talking earlier about the change, and like Bethany, in your description of what you gave a moment ago, I rate between a 1 and a 3. Now, how does that relate to ejection factors? They gave me an ejection factor estimate around 45%. Is that about what that would equal out to, or has my condition worsened to that?
So let's talk about you're the perfect example of what the VA was trying to do in the past. So, yes, you have symptoms at 1 to 3 meds. That would give you a higher disability rating percentage. But the VA didn't like that I can't take out what impact on your meds that your diabetes has, that your, let's say you have COPD, let's say that you have neuropathy. Those are going to play a part into your meds. Well, the VA didn't like the meds testing because it would put you at a higher disability rating percentage, and there's no way for us to separate out the severity of your COPD, the severity of your diabetes, and what's contributing from the neuropathy. So they weren't able to capture just the function of the heart vessels themselves. So what they were doing is they, and this is the N21, this is not the 38 CFR, what the regional office decided to do is that they were going to start looking at the ejection factors. And this is the example I said earlier, where you can have severe ischemic heart disease and have a normal ejection factor. So a 45% ejection fraction isn't bad. It's not perfect. We want to see something above 55% to be normal. You're not too low on that scale. So if they gave you the higher disability percentage based on your MET, well, they can't separate everything out. So they started looking at the ejection fraction. So when they look at your ejection fraction, they could say, well, his ejection fraction looks specifically at the heart function itself, and because the ejection fraction only pertains to the heart and doesn't pertain to his COPD or his diabetes or his neuropathy, we think that the ejection fraction is a better measure of cardiac function than a subjective MET test.
Okay, that brings up another. How frequently should you have the echo in order, like, for example, the last echo I had was probably 4 years ago, and it agreed with what I had right after my surgery, which was the 45%. How often should you have an echo to show how that heart is doing and the ejection, the estimated ejection factor?
Normally, it's an annual basis. Once your cardiac condition is stable, they're going to do it on a 1 year basis. If you're having other issues, then they do it more frequently. But if you're stable, every year.
So if I hadn't had one in 3 years, I need to ask my doctor to give me one, huh?
You should.
Okay, because I'll see him next month.
Remember, Ray, it's not based off that off the ejection fraction anymore. I mean, they used to use ejection fraction as a golden rule. Now it's, the metabolic equivalent. So, but what Bethany's saying is, if you've got symptomology for yourself, if you can get that condition and it shows 1 to 3, then the CMP examiner has to put the same thing down there if they ask questions. You know, but it also
correct.
Depends
well,
on what other conditions you got. You know, because I mean, for example, mine's 35.
and my diaphragm is paralyzed. So my oxygen level drops when I start moving. So I think I should be 100%, but I just haven't done it yet. I think I should, but, you know, it's just, you know, there's a lot of worms to open up. There's a lot of cans out there.
Yeah.
Now, mine was rated off the old ejection fraction, which was, at the time, 28%. I kind of think it's a little more precise than the metabolic method.
Yeah.
But now, Anthony, you're talking about it including other things. But an old veteran like us, you know, we don't walk the treadmill. They take us and they do the injection on the table. That speeds our heart up. Looks like that would isolate our heart and take the factors of neuropathy and leg problems out of the equation.
That's the thing.
So they don't like to do the chemical stress test because of the risk it poses to triggering a heart attack. So I've talked before about a case where that's what happened. If he went for a stress test, and they had to stop the chemical stress test because he developed a heart attack and was transferred to the local hospital for stent placement. So, and honestly, for the DBQ, the examiner may pull from a more recent exercise stress test. They may document one from 5 or 6 years ago, but they should still be asking these questions related to the mess. They should be asking about mowing the grass, taking a shower, things that you're capable of doing, because them not asking means that they're already against you, because it's right here in the DBQ. And what they've added to the DBQ, which is what I think is nice, is they have asked for that provider to use their clinical judgment to isolate what is solely related to the cardiac system. So they're supposed to write, you know, what you're saying that you're experiencing, and then they're supposed to provide details about just the cardiac function as it relates to the other contributing conditions. The other part that I feel about this is I feel that maybe more accurate than the ejection fraction, because we're looking at inside the blood vessel. We're not looking at muscle. You can have a veteran who has had 5 cardiac stents on 3 separate procedures over a 10-year period, and they're going to have a normal ejection fraction. Now, clinically, we're looking at 5 stents 3 separate times. They're having an ongoing progressive coronary artery disease. So for me, they're going to have a more severe ischemic heart condition than will ever affect their cardiac muscle because they're being proactive. So there is some debate on, you know, whether the MET testing is more accurate or the echo looking at the heart muscle is more accurate. I tend to look at the MET.
Bethany, I got a question for you.
Go for
it. Is there any casual relationship to a veteran with ischemic heart disease and low ejection fraction or, you know, the heart issues to that also has a bad case of orthostatic hypertension? Do they play hand in hand, or what's that bring into play?
So it can. Again, it's going to depend on each individual veteran and their story. Sometimes that's going to come from how well the heart is pumping itself. But if the ischemic heart disease is severe enough that it impacts the muscle function, yes, you can have issues with your blood pressure. Also, with congestive heart failure, not only the amount of fluid that you retain, but the medications you are on to get rid of the fluid play a significant role in your blood pressure.
Okay. Basically, it's mine's been up and down, so we'll figure it out.
Brings up another question. AFib. My heart doctor told me that he had never seen anyone that had diabetes that didn't have AFib. Is that where it goes hand in hand, or does it come from a ischemic heart?
So I think that's really up for debate, mainly because for diabetes in and of itself, you have an elevated glucose within the blood vessels. Diabetics are known to develop that hardening of the artery that we talked about earlier, because that sugar, those sugar molecules scrape along the blood vessels, and the body's constantly trying to repair. So in that scenario, you get that arteriosclerotic blood vessel. So it's going to harden. So then that's going to affect how well the oxygen goes from inside the blood vessel to the heart muscle, to the electrical function. We still have to maintain good oxygen exchange with the heart muscle. So is the AFib coming from the hardened arteries associated with diabetes? Is it coming from any type of nerve damage that is triggered by diabetes? So there's a lot that actually plays into that. They say that the number one killer of your diabetics is ischemic heart disease because of the vessel damage that it does. And a lot of diabetics have silent heart attacks and heart trouble because of that.
But it also affects your vascular structure too, don't it? Like, say, for example, you know, your heart pumps your blood through your lung and then brings oxygenated blood down through your lower extremities, but then it transfers over to a vein and comes back up, and if those vein valves are bad, then it's going to pull your legs and feet. It's going to have a hard time getting back to the heart, right?
Right.
Okay. So it all runs hand in hand. Especially diabetes makes it worse too, guys. You see people getting their feet cut off all the time because of that.
So I want to take a few minutes here just to finish up a little bit of what the BBQ has left. So we're on the bottom of page 9. I've talked about the functional impact. Sometimes the providers don't ask functional impact or the occupational impact that your heart condition has in your life. So I always tell my veterans, put that in your statement. Talk about how your heart condition impairs your ability to do certain things in a work environment or even for activities of daily living. Not only is that providing your statement, providing that evidence into the record for the heart condition, but if you're trying to apply for IU or aid in attendance, now we have in the record the troubles that you're having performing functional duties as it relates to your heart condition. So always put that in your statement, get that into the record as evidence. The last section is just the examiner's certification of signature, just providing contact information for that examiner. And then they leave most of page 10 blank, which could have been helpful to use in the history or something else. But if the veteran is being seen in person for this, this exam can take 30 to 45 minutes in person. If it's conducted by phone, it can typically take only 20 minutes over the phone. Any questions about that BBQ? Now, I know we didn't get to the arrhythmias. I am going to provide some information on the arrhythmias. I don't know if I'm going to do that in like a separate audio or something, maybe that we can share just to touch briefly on it. It'd be another 10, 20 minutes to talk about the arrhythmias. But I think talking mainly about the primary component and really emphasizing that these examiners should be asking the next question. And if you're getting rated based off your ejection fraction, you need to take another look at your disability rating.
Sounds like a good idea.
Well, How would you do that, John? Would you come up and ask for a reevaluation on your heart after you go to your heart doctor? And like I know that in my case, I'm like James. I'm back when the ejection factor was the only thing they went on, and it was automatic that if you had had at least a double bypass and your ejection factor was below 50, that was a 60% rating regardless. Has this new way of doing it changed any?
It basically what he's saying, it changed it because there are adding other factors involved. You know, folks with lung disease and things like that, they have, you know, it all works together. So your heart and lungs work together. And say, for example, like me, my diaphragm's paralyzed and my heart has to pump blood through that lung. That lung don't want to take it because the diaphragm doesn't work to push the blood back out. So the diaphragm, you know, helps your heart because it actually squeezes the blood through your body. So it makes it hard and it makes it a lot more difficult. So that's one reason why she's looking at it that way, because there's more factors involved. And basically just the heart muscle itself is what the ejection fraction is based on, because it's based on what the heart's pumping ability of the heart by itself. Okay, she's thinking that the metabolic equivalents also include the vascular structure, the vessels, the ischemic heart disease, which is the calcifications or the plaque inside your arteries causing your heart to have to work harder just to pump blood through it. Is that what you're saying, Bethany?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. What yeah. I keep in mind what the rating schedule says about the Met. So let me look at the 38 CFR. We talked about a Met of 3 or less. So we're looking at, let me pull it up here. If you are developing, okay, what page is that? There we go. If you are developing breathlessness, fatigue, chest pain, dizziness, passing out, or other cardiac symptoms while you're taking a shower, dressing, eating, slow walking, which is 2 miles per hour for 1 to 2 blocks. Okay, that's actually quite a bit. So if you're doing any of those things and you're developing cardiac symptoms, that is 100% disability rated. If you are developing breathlessness, fatigue, chest pain, dizziness, or passing out, any other cardiac symptoms while you are weeding in your yard, if you're doing a brisk walk or power mowing your lawn, that is a 3 to 5 Met equivalent, and that is a 60% rating. From the conversation we've had, it sounds like that you're getting those symptoms while you're eating, dressing, taking a shower, slow walking. That puts you on
bending over.
Yep.
Bending over does it too.
Yeah, it does.
Right, you know. My wife tries to help me up, and then there's somebody yells timber.
Well, you know, my actual rating is for an implanted cardio defibrillator. I don't think I have
a
rating.
Higher rating for that.
You will get a higher.
Yeah, I've been in constant AFib since 97. Ischemic heart disease, all kind of rhythm problems, but my only rating on my heart is the implanted defibrillator, and
right. That's
all I need, you know.
Yeah. Until we get our friend, then you get that, James.
Well, you know, you could pile on to all the other conditions, and it's not going to raise your percentage. I think they give one rating for the heart, don't they, Bethany? So you couldn't have 100 for implanted cardio defibrillator and then another one for ventricular rhythm problems and stack another one on for AFib. And I think there's only one rating possible at 100%.
We call that an Egyptian rating, James. That'd be pyramidic.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, Bethany, here's a good one now. Okay, say, for example, you've got AFib. I've got it. I'm sure Ray's got it. And James has got it. You can also have more than one type of arrhythmia, too.
Yeah, I don't know if that would benefit you on the rating schedule, but yeah, you can definitely have more than one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I the whole diabetes and AFib together thing, that doesn't excite me too much.
Well, we're part of the Eloquence Army, I guess they call us.
Well, if you're going to have V-fib, you best get you one of them defibrillators.
That's the arrhythmia you definitely do not want.
Yeah. That's the main reason for the defibrillator, James. That's
right.
The arrhythmia. That's kind of an automatic, you know. They'll give you a defibrillator for other reasons, but, I mean, you know, it all depends on, to the condition
you have. Like I say, you have to argue, you have to ask and advocate for yourself to get the defibrillator over the pacemaker, because the first thing they're going to want to do is put a pacemaker in.
Well, 30 more,
you know, that's fine and dandy, but it doesn't take the place of defibrillator.
You know, I will tell you that insurance is probably what drives that more than anything.
Oh, Kitching syndrome?
I was actually on the table having I was supposed to get a replacement pacemaker. And in the middle of the operation with my chest open, I asked the surgeon, are you putting in a defibrillator or a pacemaker? And he said, I'm under the understanding I'm to put a pacemaker in. I said, I was under the understanding you were going to do a defibrillator. He said, hold on. And he went over to the telephone, made a phone call, and he came back and he said, young man, you just earned yourself a defibrillator. So he's putting this defibrillator in, and it jumps out of his hands. I saw it go up in the air. And he said, man, I wish I'd have known that to start with. I'd have cut that pocket a little deeper.
Oh, man.
Oh, but one important thing before we go, the rating schedule itself. Now, it used to say that any medical test you have, there's a difference between the heart cath and the echocardiogram. The echo is a ultrasound look at your heart, okay? But the actual heart cath itself is actually going up into your vessels with a catheter, through a catheter looking at each vessel. So the echo is not – so basically the heart cath is a boss test. So it carries more weight.
Yeah, it's the gold standard. I had one of those a couple of days ago. You know, they go through your neck now. It used to go through your groin. And
they used to
there's
my
nothing
arm
to
one
it.
Time.
You know, you feel a little bee sting, and that's it, you know.
Well, you feel some tugging, don't you? Yank, 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 tug, tug. I did.
I didn't hear you.
You feel some yanking and tugging and things like that, and they move out.
Pulling and pushing. Mm-hmm. But they give you that happy juice, and you don't care.
Oh, okay. You the mighty morphine Power Ranger.
Yeah.
No. Bethy, you ever worked in a heart cath lab?
No, I have not.
That'd be an interesting thing. Get into it.
That is one happy place.
I don't want to participate.
A lot of things are going on. People are talking and laughing and joking, and you know, there's some good crews down there doing that kind of stuff.
What my wife used to run the film, James. She sits there with them all day long. She's the one that ran the. It's all live X-ray. It's under fluoro. But you're getting nuked while you do that, right?
Yeah.
To them, it's a big joke. To you, it's serious. But it puts your mind at ease. You know, they're laughing and joking and talking and cutting up, and it just makes you feel at ease. I'm all for those people.
Well, guys, I hate to say this. I might have some bad news.
Are we out of time?
We're totally out of time, so we're good. But that's good. I mean, that's you know, we get this thing like this going. But I guess we'll have to come back next month and do another one, Bill.
No, it sounds good to me.
All right. So I don't know which one you want to tackle, but the further you go, the harder they get.
I know. I was looking at that. I'm actually thinking we're going to touch peripheral vascular. Stay with the vascular and get it knocked out because there's only three of them. So.
Vascular. Okay.
So that's your varicose veins, your peripheral artery disease.
Cover Raynaud's too if you can. A lot of diabetics get Raynaud for some reason.
Okay.
That's when your feet turn purple and black.
Okay.
Well, I don't need to run an ending tonight, guys. It's not recording anyway, so that's good. We cut off right about the good time. And but it was a really good show. Hope people learned something, especially these heart disease folks need to get a handle on it and see what they can come up with as far as, you know, what they're rating, if they're rating correctly. So I don't think I am. I don't think Ray is either.
Well, it's not going to help me to get any higher rating. I mean,
right.
You know, when you're an R2, you're an R2. And
yeah,
like you said earlier to James, unless they come out with an R3, we're stuck.
Yeah. Well, I think we should advocate for R3. We need help doing that. So let's get us to R3. Maybe even R4. Which will probably give you a Star Wars rating, call you R2-D2.
There you go. I like that.
You already got mechanical parts in your body. You'd be a robot.
Sure.
You know, at the point that you're drawing R2 pay, you can't kick on that. You know, that's very good pay. Very good compensation. It compensates me for my disabilities. But it doesn't take care of my kids. You know, I hate the fact that it's affected my kids, and it's actually been passed down to them. You know, there is no compensation level to make up for that.
Let me tell you a good one, James. There's back when they were doing the Revolution TV show, we was involved with that, and one of the actors was doing those lines, and he basically his character was an executive for Google. And he owned a jet airplane. And they were climbing onto a jet airplane. And he was telling the cute girls what he'd done and stuff, you know, and that, you know, that he was a millionaire and he owned his airplane. And he said he'd trade it all right now for a roll of Charmin. So, I mean, if I could,
well,
you know, get your health back, you know, I take it all back, you know.
I volunteered my time, and I knew what the dangers were, and you know, we were in a dangerous business, but I didn't volunteer the lives of my kids. Never contemplated that it would affect them.
Agent Orange, bad stuff, buddy. I think there need to be more things that's fine a bit for that to the list, to tell you the truth.
Well, you know, they've actually come up with a Vanderbilt professor in her lab actually wrote the novel that I'm in, Lives Intertwined. They have come up with a way to replace that strand of DNA that Agent Orange has erased. I need to talk to her and find out more about it, find out where that research is going.
Wow.
You've mentioned that before.
Get some DNA scissors, start cutting. That would be amazing if you found that out, buddy. Let me get that doctor on the show. Let's interview her.
She says they have it done. At the Vietnam Veterans Welcome Home Day celebration, she was a guest speaker. And she says they have separated that gene out and they figured out a way to stop it in the bloodline. She is on my website along with her contact information. She runs her own lab at VA Medical University.
Vanderbilt?
Yeah.
Well, she's got the right place because you got to be one important, smart cookie just to walk into Vanderbilt.
Well, yes, you do. And I met her at that celebration, and I wanted to buy her books. And she wanted to know when I was in Vietnam. I said I wasn't in Vietnam, but I won the very first Agent Orange claim in the continental United States. So she reaches over and grabs a volume, flips it to chapter 67. She said, "You're in my book."
That's why.
She never thought she would meet me, and I didn't know the book existed.
Now you do.
Oh, yeah.
Now you do.
Yeah, I bought the set of books.
Well, you got number one and number two here, so that's good.
Yep.
Yep. Well, listen, I want to go ahead and shut her down, guys. Y'all have a tremendous weekend, March Friday. Enjoy the rain because it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but let's do this again next month.
Bethany, appreciate what you do.
Yep.
Not a problem. Thank you for having
really
me, and I appreciate the time. Hopefully it helps. If one person learns, it's worth it.
You got more than one person learning then, lady. You got a bunch. You got a bunch. I got all kinds of feedback. Yeah. You're like, who's that young lady?
I appreciate that.
Get all the... Okay. All right. Well, listen, let's go ahead and shut it down. Everybody have a good evening. And we will, we'll take off and be like a scheduled airline, and we'll see everybody again next week.
All right. Sounds good. Have a good one.
All right. Bye.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.